Good morning once again. Some of you may be thinking, why are we reading the same scripture passage that was read last week? Any of you thinking that? Or did you remember that it was read last week? It was read last week, and it has been intentionally done this way. When Jared and I read the lectionary, we really thought that there was a two sermon that one sermon couldn't do justice to. So Jared preached on the content of the message, the reading of Isaiah 61 and what it might mean for us. And I think Jared did an excellent job in interpreting what that passage might mean for us. But I've always, when I read this passage in Luke 4, my interest was in not the content of the message itself, okay, but the response of the people to the message itself. Okay, now the message was essentially a summarizing statement of the theme of Jubilee. Jubilee, which is described in the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament. And basically the Jubilee was that every 50th year, okay, every 50th year, God commanded Israel to release the captives, meaning slaves who are under their indenture. On 50th year will be released. The land will be given relief from farming. Okay, debts of people will be forgiven. And all of the people will be restored in this 50th year where everything is restored. Now, there is no actual recording, historical recording of Israel actually did this, forgiving people's debts, releasing slaves, and giving the land the relief. Okay? However, this theme of Jubilee became to be kind of embedded into the messianic hope. Okay? Messianic hope of Israel. Okay? And so when Jesus summarized Isaiah 61 by saying, good news to the poor, release of the captive, recovery of the sight of the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, this last phrase, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, is a direct reference to that Jubilee year. And what Jesus said was that in your hearing, that Jubilee, that theme of release and redemption has come upon you. No wonder people loved it. No wonder people responded positively. But not only that, but what's really interesting about the way that Jesus states this theme of Jubilee in Isaiah is what he leaves out. Okay? Right after that statement, proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, Isaiah 61 continues with this phrase, the day of vengeance of our God. So Jesus takes that vengeance piece out and proclaims the year of the Lord's favor. Now, no wonder people are absolutely pleased and gleeful in hearing the message. Now, at this point, Jesus should have left the good alone, but his sermon apparently continued. And this is where all things go wrong. The mood and the responses of the people change drastically after a brief dialogue between Jesus and the people, doesn't it? In verse 28, it says, and all in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up and drove him out of town and led him to a brow of the hill on which their town was built so that they might hurl him off the cliff. Now, I've preached a bad sermon or two in my day, some of which you have heard personally and have received many unfavorable comments, but I don't think anybody ever wanted to throw me off the cliff. Or did you? The question is this, why the switch? What caused the switch in that brief conversation? What nerve did Jesus touch that people in the synagogue would respond so violently and change their direction so drastically from a gracious reception of hearing the message of Isaiah 61, the year of Jubilee, to being violent and even murderous towards Jesus? Let me take you I think this is an interesting question. Let me take you, because I think here, Jesus once again reveals something profound and deeply ingrained in the human nature that he addresses and reveals some truth about who God is in the midst of that. So let's look at the text more closely. First, Jesus, as he always does throughout the Gospels, sees in almost an X-ray vision into the deepest thoughts and patterns of the human heart. And he speaks what they're thinking and feeling and voices them out. He voices it in this well-known proverb called, that says, doctor, cure yourself. In other words, Jesus recognizes, even as he's proclaiming the year of the Jubilee and hearing the good response of the people, he sees deeply, more deeply into what they're thinking and feeling. And what they're thinking is this proverb, doctor, cure yourself. Now, translation is required. What is this statement referring to? Basically, a simple translation is this: do now for your own what you have done for others. In other words, the people who heard the sermon, the proclamation of the year of the Lord's favor, okay, were hearing it as insiders, coming from one of their own. Isn't this Joseph's son, is what they say, right? In other words, this year of Jubilee, this blessing of God that's coming, must now come to us because you are one of our own. This thought pattern of us versus them, okay, so deeply rooted, Jesus hears it and sees it and he begins to prod into it. So he tells a story that counters their basic fundamental belief that this God of Israel was now going to bless the people of Israel, and specifically the people of Nazareth and Galilee, because Jesus comes from one of us, right? Okay. So he tells two stories from the Old Testament and reverses the pattern of thinking about who God is and what God does. He tells the two stories, one about a widow in Zarephath. Zarephath was a Gentile territory widow, a poverty-stricken widow, and he says there were lots of people, lots of widows in Israel, but God never healed any of them, but went to a Zarephath, to a Gentile territory in Zarephath to heal a widow. What's he saying? What's he confronting? He was confronting the notion that God was for them, for us, and not for them. And then he tells a second story to reinforce the idea. He tells a second story, a Syrian, a general named Naaman. And he says, there were lots of lepers in Israel, but God didn't heal them either. Instead, he healed the leper Assyrian general. Now, why would Jesus do this? Jesus here is directly challenging the parochial, tribal kind of God that they worship. They believed that when the year of the Lord's favor was proclaimed, that it was for me and us, but not so much about what God was doing for them. Jesus opens at the deeply rooted and seated ways human beings have always lived on this side of Eden as tribes of people living competitively against others in limited resource on earth, and even for God's favor. I call this tribalism. People of Nazareth were guilty of tribalism. They lived in a deeply divided world with invisible and yet very real rings of concentric circles around them. And these concentric circles defined who was in and who was out. Who is us and who is them. And in between that us and them world, there was God. And for all they knew, they always believed that the God was for us and God was against them. Closer you were in the concentric circles, closer you were to the people, and further away you were, the further you were away from merit, concern, and care, and protection. When I grew up here in Canada among in an Italian neighborhood, predominantly Italian, so my friends' names were Angelo Rigitano. I mean, how cool can that be? In Italian community, I quickly learned that we are deeply rooted in this tribalism. If you are one of their tribe, you're in. They will take care of you. They will give the shirt off your back. But if you are not one of us, then you are one of them. Tribalism is not just among the Italians or the Nazarenes. Tribalism is alive and well today, isn't it? Alive and well. Those of you who grew up in Edinburgh, did I say that right? Edinburgh? Is that how you say it? Not bad. Okay, you give me some grace. Edinburgh, know what it is to think of those who came from Glasgow, perhaps. Or the Highlanders, thinking of the rest of the folk who come from the lowlands. And those of you who grew up in Northern Ireland, you know what it means to be orange and those who are not. For those of us who grew up a proud Presbyterians, you know what it is to think about those Catholics just up the road, who, by the way, were taught and thought to be bound for the fiery furnace of hell for the errors of their ways, right? For me, growing up in South Korea, and even here in Canada in the Korean communities, tribalism was defined not just by geography, but by education, skin tone, the way you dress, and the dialect you spoke. Soon as the words come out of your mouth, they knew, people know whether you are us or you were them. And if you were them, then they were thought to be beyond the blessing and the concern and the care of God whom I worship, who is my God and our God. The boundaries of tribe in today is arbitrary. It can be established on any number of criteria, but it always has someone or some group as identified as the other. Okay? And that other group is just beyond the reaches and the blessing of the God I worship, because I believe that he favors me and us over them. In tribalism, there is always an us and them, and this is the world, the thoughts and the hearts and the mind of people. When they heard Jesus proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, they heard it as a message for us, but had no regard for the them. In this divided and tribal world, Jesus presents a new theology. Not new, actually, old theology, but one that they had not fully grasped. And that this theology and belief of a God is that this God that they worshipped and trusted in and believed and followed had no boundaries, no concentric circles beyond which he did not exercise his will and power. God didn't have an us and then them, but God had one group, one us. There wasn't a boundary or barriers or concentric circles that God didn't want to cross or he was willing to cross. He had no favorites in his kingdom and in his world. Indeed, the Bible confirms this, that Jesus came into the world and God sent his only son into the world because God so loved the world and all that was in it. People understood God to be their exclusive God who only favored them. But in Jesus, God of Israel was not God of one people of the earth, but God of all peoples, tribes, and nations of people who acted not just on the behalf of his own people, but on behalf of all. He would dare to cross the neighborhood lines. He would dare to cross the fences that we erect and minister to the other, whom we find troubling. Question for this morning is this, through this text. How big is your God? Is your God still a God of your particular tribe, however you have come to define your tribe? Or is this God whom we came to here to worship so big so grand, so generous and magnanimous that he dares to cross any and all boundaries we might erect. And he is there already in the world, beyond the church walls, beyond our conception of who is in and who is out. Isn't he already there blessing and enriching and proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor? He is. That's what Jesus came to show the world, that this God was not a tribal small God, but a big God who cared for all people and all things in the world. God is in the world beyond us, even in groups of people and characters whom you and I might find objectionable. But that's where he is. And he invites us to experience this magnanimous, big and huge and generous God who seeks to bless all people. The task for us today is to draw our circles little ever wider, just a little wider, because that's where God is, just beyond our walls and boundaries. There's a wonderful book that our presbyter has been reading, and Jen and I have been reading it together. And the book is called Pastorix, written by the Reverend Nadia Bowles Weber. She's a foul-mouthed, tattoo-clad Lutheran pastor who writes beautifully and wonderfully in this book, who is so deeply spiritual. And in this book, one line, one sentence just really stuck with me, and I haven't been able to erase it, and it's just wonderful. So let me read it for you. Careful, warning, language is, well, it's out there. This is how she writes. She says this: "The thing that sucks is that every time we draw a line between us and others, Jesus is always on the other side of it." Damn. Isn't that wonderful? But the question is, does that anger you, or does that melt your heart? Because God is so gracious and loving and powerful and big and magnanimous and generous to all people. I hope it warms our hearts. Amen.